Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the Justice Department is suing a nonprofit that shelters unaccompanied migrant kids over allegations of sexual abuse.
And why homes for sale in the Valley may not be the way out of this housing crisis.
But first, Vice President Kamala Harris has won support of enough delegates to next month's Democratic National Convention to become the presumptive presidential nominee. That came within a day of President Joe Biden announcing he was ending his run for re-election. The weeks between now and when Democrats gather in Chicago will be closely watched, as will the convention itself when it gets started on August 19th. Carl Gentles will be there. He's a delegate from Arizona, and he's here with me now to talk about the last few days and what the next few months may hold. Carl, good morning.
Good morning.
So were you surprised that President Biden ultimately called it quits?
Well, I was a bit surprised. I think the majority of delegates and Democrats really want to see it through. But ultimately, I think the mounting pressure on him just became too much. And it was clear that the tide was going against him. And one thing you'll know and you have seen from President Joe Biden is that Joe Biden is really a selfless, one of the most selfless politicians, leaders that we have. And he really decided that, you know, it was for the best of the country and the best of the party that I step aside. And what made his decision even easier was the fact that he had a Vice President, Kamala Harris, and just a formidable teammate, running mate, to make his decision a little bit easier.
I wanted to ask you about that because there had been some speculation that maybe he wouldn't endorse Kamala Harris or anybody and the Democrats would have somewhat of an open convention. But that clearly is not the case. And now Vice President Harris seems to be the presumptive nominee.
She is absolutely a presumptive nominee. And you will see when we get to the convention and before the convention that she will have wrapped up that nomination before we get there. In fact, there will be a virtual roll call vote prior to getting to the convention. Just a straw poll just recently, as of a couple of days ago, that showed that she's already got the number of delegates to carry the nomination.
Are you supportive of that?
I'm absolutely supportive of her and taking a roll call and making sure that when we get to the convention that there's as little drama as possible, because our focus, Democrats' focus, needs to be on prosecuting the case against Donald Trump and prosecuting the case for the extension, by extension, the Biden administration through Kamala Harris. And by the way, she will extend those policies and that great track record, but she's going to create some real new policies and real successes all on her own.
What have the conversations been like between sort of within Democratic circles? Maybe I don't know if you've had a chance to speak with any of your co-delegates, your fellow delegates, you know, going to Chicago next month. Like, how have those conversations evolved, I guess, maybe from Saturday before President Biden announced he wasn't going to run to Sunday when he was to yesterday when Kamala Harris got all the support, you know, on all the endorsements, record-breaking fundraising totals, that kind of thing? I'm curious, like, what those conversations sounded like.
Well, you know, I can only speak to the conversations I've had personally.
Sure.
And across the board with the people I've spoken to and had been speaking to and been in touch with, they all supported Biden and wanted to see him stay in the race and see it through because he had not only earned delegate support, we all voted for him, we're all committed to him as delegates. And so we really wanted to see that successful campaign march forward, a successful campaign and the Biden march forward. But it became very clear. And by the way, I'll say this, that we're Biden delegates until in such time that he decides not to run, which is what he did. And so that then effectively releases us to become delegates for somebody else. And, of course, the most natural choice, because it was a team, it's a Biden-Harris team. we, of course, are moving our vote and supporting Kamala Harris.
All right, so I've got to ask you about sort of the big question now, which is who might Kamala Harris pick as her running mate? And Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, his name has been bandied about. There was some reporting that vetting information was sent to him to see if he might be a good pick. What do you think about who she might choose?
Well, when you're thinking about this vice president choice for this election, it really comes down to strategy. It really comes down to electoral map strategy and who can deliver in about five or six states. First of all, the person that she picks should be able to and will be able to carry, hopefully, their state.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have four to five states that we've got to ensure that we've got a pathway to win. And those that pathway includes Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and even North Carolina, and of course, Arizona. You might even look down into Georgia as well. So it's my opinion that this is a chess game now. Whoever she chooses has to be able to deliver at least those three states, those top three states, and then deliver on the other four or five if possible, because this election is going to come down to it's a margin of error election. That's it. It's between 1 to 3 points in terms of who's going to win in each of those states. And so whoever can carry that, I think, is going to be the choice. Mark Kelly potentially absolutely can. He's got the great resume. He is. Of course, we are biased because we love Mark Kelly, and he's here in Arizona, and he can carry Arizona. The question is, who is it that's going to be able to deliver those three most important states, which includes the three that I talked about?
I mean, it would seem like, based on what you're saying, maybe someone from the upper Midwest, someone from Pennsylvania or Michigan might be a slightly better choice.
I'd probably handicap it as such, again, because we're talking political strategy here. This mm-hmm. is not a beauty pageant, and we have to deliver somebody that can literally walk in and say they can carry those states. That's really what it comes down to. I think Mark Kelly is a great choice. We have some great, as somebody said, the Democrats have a great bench, and we're choosing between maybe nine candidates, as many as nine candidates. So I think whomever we choose, it really does come back to that chess game and that electoral map strategy, which is the most important thing here.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Carl Gentles of the Gentles Agency. He'll be a delegate to the Democratic National Convention coming up in just a few weeks in Chicago. Carl, good to see you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Southwest Key Programs is the nation's largest operator of shelters for migrant children who arrive in the U.S. unaccompanied. It has played a crucial role in the shelter system for two decades, working with the federal government to house these children throughout the border region, including several shelters here in Arizona. And it's also been awarded millions in federal funds to do this work. But now the Justice Department is suing Southwest Key over allegations of repeatedly subjecting the minors in its care to sexual harassment and abuse. Ashvarya Kavi is covering the story for the New York Times, and she joins us now to tell us more. And warning, this conversation may not be appropriate for all audiences. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us first about these allegations by the Justice Department. What did they say Southwest Key has allowed to happen here?
Right. So the lawsuit alleges that between about 2015 and at least last year, 2023, there were employees of Southwest Key regularly subjecting migrant children, basically children and teenagers who were placed in Southwest Key's care by the federal government. These children were abused. There are rape allegations, there are solicitations of sex. Minors were threatened and blackmailed for nude photos. They were leered at. You know, a clinician in one case asked very inappropriate questions about a teenage girl's sexual history, and there are startling allegations. And the broader picture here, though, is that the Department of Justice is trying to prove that this is a systematic abuse, mm-hmm. that this regularly happened to children placed in Southwest Key's care.
Right. So talk more about that, the role of Southwest Key here. It was their employees, obviously, who allegedly did these things. But did they have any protections in place for these kids? Was there any sort of, you know, checks and balances?
Yeah. So one of the main points that the prosecutors make in this lawsuit is that employees didn't follow neither Southwest Key's guidelines to protect children nor the Department of Health and Human Services. And the HHS is who places these children in the care of contractors like Southwest Key. So there are different policies in place, you know, to prevent employees from developing improper relationships with children, from being alone with them at night or certain times of the day. And these were not followed by employees. And that's what prosecutors discovered when they sort of compiled the reports of abuse that they had available to them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What has Southwest Key had to say about these accusations?
You know, they put out a very generic statement that they're still focused on the health and well-being of the children they care for. But I think a big takeaway here is that they, and something they noted, is that they continue to work very closely with HHS mm-hmm. and the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And they're still the largest contractor. They still have government contracts and, you know, more than 6,000 children in their care right now.
So I want to back up for a minute and talk about how this industry works. The New York Times published a lengthy investigation into Southwest Key back in 2018, finding it's like a lucrative industry and there's little transparency. Can you tell us more about what was found then?
Yeah, so several colleagues of mine at the Times back in 2018 discovered that Southwest Key was basically funneling federal money into for-profit businesses that would get contracts with Southwest Key. Mm-hmm. And they were using these for-profit businesses as a way to supplement the earnings of their top executives. So at the time, Juan Sanchez, who was the founder of Southwest Key, he was making more money than the head of the American Red Cross. Mm-hmm. He was making almost $2 billion a year and $2 million a year, sorry. And he
resigned after that investigation
right? Yes, he resigned. Mm-hmm. And there was a federal investigation into their financial improprieties as well. It seems like this particular lawsuit is not related to that, but it is, in fact, a very financially lucrative business. Mm-hmm. And the children crossing the border will continue to need housing.
Right. Like, and during the Trump administration, the spotlight was on Southwest Key again, right, because of former President Trump's family separation policy. It was a big financial boon to this kind of industry.
Yeah, exactly. So the family separation policy that was primarily in 2017 and 2018, that funneled a huge additional number of children to contractors like Southwest Key, because they were not only the federal government was not only sending unaccompanied minors to these shelters, but also minors who were separated from the parents and guardians that they crossed the border with. So there was a dire need for housing at that time, and the federal government paid providers like Southwest Key for it.
Right. So this is one lawsuit involving this one contractor. But it sounds like, I mean, are there bigger questions here about the accountability and transparency that are being addressed at the federal government level?
Yeah. So this lawsuit has kind of shed a light on the abuse that we have had sort of incremental reports on over the years. Mm-hmm. And so it is one of the ways that it seems that the federal government is looking to hold these providers accountable. And one of the things that the prosecutors in this case are looking for, besides financial compensation for the children who are abused, they're looking to mandate Southwest Key to better adhere to guidelines and to be penalized as well for their practices.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Aishwarya Kavi covering this story for The New York Times. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why one Valley resident traded cubicles and office chairs for gongs and singing bowls.
But first, the Valley's housing market has been the subject of a lot of conversation over the past several months. Prices have been high and the number of homes for sale has been relatively low. But my next guest recently noticed something kind of surprising. The number of active listings was going up. In fact, the data showed at the end of last month, there were more homes for sale than at the same time in 2017, 2018, or 2019. John Wake is a real estate analyst in the Valley. He joins me to talk more about this. And John, you've been watching and noticing that the number of homes for sale is going up, especially at a time when that typically doesn't happen.
Yeah, the reason people talked about the home prices skyrocketed in 2021 and 2022, and people were saying, oh, it's because there's so little inventory. There's not many homes for sale, so they're bidding up prices. And now we're seeing that the number of homes for sale has been increasing at a time of year, the first 6 months, where they usually go down. That's the high season. Usually the number of homes for sale goes down. It's been going up a little bit. Not tremendously, but going up. And now we're back to the point in June where it was back to June 2017 levels. So that's kind of like a normal year. So now we're back. So the number of homes for sale is about normal right now.
Do you have a sense of why that is? Why all of a sudden there are this many more homes on the market?
Yeah, well, it's going to be – the question is it people putting more homes on the market, or is it because sales are so low? So it's one of the two. So it's mainly because sales are so low. The number of sales in June were the lowest for June since 2008 during the crash.
Yeah,
so
not
that
good
was
times.
A low number of sales. So that's mainly what it's happening because the interest rates are so high. People aren't buying unless they have cash. Or lots of times, if you're selling a home at the same time you're buying, it's kind of a wash. Prices are way up, but it doesn't matter because you're paying a lot more for the house, but you're making a lot more on the house that you're selling. So that's kind of a wash. That's kind of the people that are still active is people that have a lot of equity in their current home.
So does that suggest to you that maybe the news isn't as good as it would look on face value? You know, as you talked about, you know, prices were so high, the thinking went because there weren't enough houses for sale. Now there are more houses for sale, but maybe it's not quite as good. Maybe we're not seeing prices go down the way you might expect them to.
Yeah, well, homes are famous for having sticky on the downside, as they say on prices. It's people are like saying, well, I think my house is worth this. If I don't get the price, I'm not going to sell it. So they just take it off the market. So
yeah.
The biggest danger is we go into a recession because the market is kind of wobbly. Like I said, there's very few sales, but the prices are basically, oh, like 1% more than they were a year ago, but they're like 4% less than they were 2 years ago. We've basically been flat prices for 2 years. If we get into a recession, that would be bad for prices. But then again, if we get into a recession, the Fed will start lowering interest rates, which would tend to support prices. So on the other hand.
So when you look at the lack of sales, is that mostly an interest rate issue?
Yeah, that's mainly an interest rate issue is the sales for sure. There could have been that there were so many sales earlier that the people like bought, you know, they stole the sales from the future when the things were so hot a couple years ago. But it's mainly just the price. The prices are so high, and plus the interest rates are so high. It's a terrible combination. When you look at it, the prices together, the prices with the interest rates are about as high as they were in 2006. Yikes.
Before the crash,
yeah.
So does that tell you then that this is not necessarily good news, for example, for first-time home buyers? Like we've been hearing a lot about first-time home buyers trying to get in the market. This doesn't sound like great conditions for them.
Oh, yeah. That's the hardest part. If you already have a home, you're fine. It's kind of a wash when you buy and sell at the same time. But those first-time home buyers, there's downside risk. What happens if something bad happens and prices start to fall? I have a son. My second son is in Florida. 2 years ago, he bought a house. And I told him, buy a 10-year house. A house you would be happy if you lived in it for 10 years. And you would be okay if it was worth what you pay 10 years from now. Because there's so much uncertainty. People thought prices were going to tank last year, and they didn't. They actually went up a little bit, like 1%. But nevertheless, they went up instead of down. So it's totally unpredictable. But that is kind of my rule of thumb is like buy a 10-year house. Some people say buy a 5-year house, a house you'll be happy with if it's at the same price 5 or 10 years from now.
So let's say that interest rates do go down at some point in the not-too-distant future. Given the number of homes on the market, does that become better news for people who are either looking to get into the market or maybe move up to a bigger, more expensive house than what they have now?
Yeah, that will definitely support the market. But on the other hand, prices are so high right now that that's putting downward pressure. So it could just offset. My working theory right now is that if the interest rates go down, it'll support prices so they don't fall.
Hmm.
But it could bring more people into the market. But it seems like prices are so high right now. It's hard to imagine they could go higher. But who knows? I've said that in the past, and it turned out they went higher.
Yeah. What are you seeing and hearing about more inventory coming on the market, either from people deciding to sell or maybe just new construction? You know, there's a lot of effort to try to get more homes in construction.
In that area, there's been talk for a long time now, a couple of years now, about people who have short-term rentals.
Mm.
Investors. Are they making less money? Will they decide to start to sell, those investors? And that would bring them up. Supply a lot. And we're kind of at a delicate point right now. Just a month from now, we'll have a lot more idea. Is the supply increasing faster than normal? If it is in August, that would be a sign that that's going to put a lot of downward pressure on prices. I'm talking about all the bad news. The good news about being a first-time buyer right now is you have a normal selection. You know, a year ago or in the past few years, you didn't have a good selection of homes to choose from.
Right.
Now you have a good selection, but you do have the downside risk of prices falling in the future.
I want to ask you about the short-term rental issue. I mean, is there evidence to suggest that there are people who own short-term rentals who are maybe looking to sell them and get out of the Airbnb business?
I haven't seen numbers on that, but I've heard lots of stories about this guy, that guy, you know, I know my neighbor, whatever.
Hmm.
But I haven't seen numbers. It hasn't been enough to influence the market, or if it does, it's not a huge influence. But that could be part of the reason that they were getting more homes for sale. Maybe some of those short-term rental investors are coming in and are trying to get out of the market.
Are they making less money on their short-term rentals?
Oh, yeah. There was a great year. What was it, 2001 or two? They made great money. And then it's been down. It's not like they're terrible money, but it's not like it as good as it was.
So it's not as lucrative a thing to own all these homes.
At the top, so many people came in. And also, there was this kind of a mania. It was kind of like a meme stock for a while, you know, where everybody's reading and they can see it online. There's a zillion, I don't know, YouTube videos and
yeah.
TikTok videos about investing in real estate and or short-term rentals. And so that was part of the reason we had such a mania in 2001, the first part of 2002.
So what will you be looking for and looking at for the next several months to really get a gauge of where this market might be going, where prices might be going, where inventory might be going?
The biggest one is the one you focused on at the beginning was the inventory. Is inventory going to get – it's normal right now. Is it going to stay like a normal year through the rest of the year, or is it going to continue increasing? And then the prices tend to go down in the second half of the year, usually, you know, not a ton.
Mm-hmm.
But they tend to go down in the second half of the year. Will they go down more than normal in the second half of the year? And what does that say about next year? But the biggest – the risk element is a recession. If we get a bigger than average recession – the Phoenix economy is doing amazingly good. It's one of the top in the country. But nevertheless, there's always that downside. Things could be worse than expected, like the last great recession. That was – who expected that?
All right. That is real estate analyst John Wake. John, thank you a lot for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Phoenix-based author Allison Brennan is prolific. She writes 3 books a year, with 45 currently in print. Brennan specializes in crime thrillers. Earlier this year, she published You'll Never Find Me, the first in what will become a series of novels about an estranged family of private investigators. The book features a different approach than Brennan's earlier works. Each chapter is written from the point of view of a different character. Brennan spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about finding new ways to tell familiar stories.
It was actually a decision I made when I was halfway through the book. I was writing the first draft of this book, and all of a sudden I was writing Margot's scenes in first person.
Mm.
And I didn't realize it at the time, because when I write my first draft, I write really fast and I'm just getting the story down. And all of a sudden I'm like looking at it, I'm going, this is in first person. And it was working so much better.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to the beginning and just took her scenes and rewrote them all in first person. And I said, okay, this is it. The rest of the book flowed so much smoother once I had that down.
I'm really digging that peek behind the curtain, because I think what makes a family story relatable to a reader or a viewer is that you think, I am also a person in a family. And most of us think of ourselves as like, I am the main character in this family. So we need somebody in the story who is also experiencing the story in that way. In the vein of this choice to write chapters from the point of view of various different characters, I was extremely interested in the choice that you have chapters written from Peter Carrillo's point of view, especially the scene with his mother, because he is very much the villain in the story. Tell me about the choice to do that and what it was like to write from his point of view.
I think as a writer, it's really important to get into the villain's point of view because the villain is the hero of his own journey. So he is a bad guy. There's not a lot of redeeming features about him. I do think he really does love his family, but it's in a warped way. And therefore, he can completely justify abusing his wife because he thinks he's doing it to keep his family together. He thinks that she is there to serve him, and she gave him two beautiful kids, and he loves his kids, and he loves his wife, and he just wants her to understand how much he loves her and that everything he is doing is for their own good. And so you take that to the extreme, and he becomes an abusive spouse. So the thing with his mom is I'm not going to say that every single child that is abused is going to grow up to be an abuser, but there's multiple kinds of abuse. There's emotional abuse. There's physical abuse. There's indifference. And so I think knowing how he grew up helps to understand how he became who he is. Doesn't justify it. It just helps explain it. And in my mind, if somebody is just a bad guy, then why can't the hero capture them? You know, right. Why – if it's just somebody, you know – that is just doing bad, then our hero is stupid if they can't put that guy in prison.
Yeah. You know, if I may, just now when you were kind of narrating Peter's inner monologue, you got very spirited and passionate in your talking about it, which doesn't make me think that you are like him. I'm not saying that. But it is emotional evidence to me that you really made the effort to understand the run of thoughts that might go through the head of somebody like this. What is it like for you just as a person to spend time in that headspace?
It's both creative and sometimes it can be a little unnerving, but I also – it's sort of like if you're a law enforcement officer, you compartmentalize. Or if you're a doctor and you're performing surgery, you kind of step aside. You can't have an emotional attachment. So I kind of – it's this kind of a weird thing. I'm in his head or any of my bad guys' heads, but at the same time, I kind of am watching it from like a godlike perspective and thinking what he thinks. So I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does. It does. And there's an interesting meta layer here too, which is that you're talking about how this ability to compartmentalize is core to the work of cops and PIs. And of course, you're writing about cops and PIs. So it's almost like you're method writing.
Maybe a little bit. I mean, I've done a lot of field trips. I've spoken to a lot of law enforcement. I've been on ride-alongs. My oldest daughter is a Phoenix PD officer. When I lived in California, I did role-playing with FBI SWAT, where I got to play a victim. I was a bad guy. I was a hostage. I've been to the morgue. I've watched an autopsy. I try to go on site and then I talk to the people because I want to know, how did you get into this line? Did you plan on being a pathologist? What do you like about your job? Do you not like about your job? I might not even have a book that I'm writing, but at least I'm trying to get into everybody's mindset to figure out why they do what they do.
I think that's really interesting in the context of the section we were just talking about where you are writing from Peter's point of view and he's on the phone with his mom who, it seems like, has been somewhat emotionally manipulative with him throughout his life. One of the things that feels to me like a concrete illustration of that godlike mode that you were describing that I think comes through in that section is that as we're reading that, Peter is not aware of the psychological impact that his mother has had on him. But by virtue of the fact that it's included, it's clear that the author of this story is aware and has put it here for a reason. So there's this interesting double thing that happens where, in a way, we are being invited to empathize with Peter, but we are also aware that the author knows that there's more going on than just his version of the story.
Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, I think it was important from the perspective because he did – it was funny because in that scene, as it's coming back to me, I remember his mom wanted to come in and fix everything, and he did not want her there. And I don't know if he consciously knew that he didn't want her there because he was afraid, you know, of her kind of taking over his household, or – if it was just that he had his plan.
So in the vein of all these things we've been talking about incorporating the points of view of multiple characters and being sort of in and out of their heads at the same time, there was another line I wanted to ask you about. And this one comes from Ava, who is the mom of the Angel Hearts, the family of private investigators. She says, "No one is all good or all bad. It's sometimes difficult to reconcile people we know with things they do. It doesn't make you a bad person to fondly remember the good times with people who loved you." And when I read that line, which comes towards the end of the book, it struck me that in a way she was kind of articulating the theme of the whole story.
She's very smart. She's a lot smarter than me.
Was there any intention about her kind of commenting on the full narrative when you wrote that line?
No, because I don't plot.
Okay.
I mean, a cool plot is a cool plot. I mean, and I read a lot of thrillers and I say, oh, that's a really cool plot. But in the end, it's all about the characters. I have to believe that if I met this person on the street, they would be a real human being. Character is story.
Yeah. Well, Alison Brennan, author of You'll Never Find Me, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Arizona Supreme Court says it's starting a new program aimed at increasing the number of attorneys in the state. According to the court, Arizona ranks 49th in the country in the number of lawyers per capita. In order to practice law in Arizona, applicants need to score a 270 on the bar exam. The Arizona Lawyer Apprentice Program will allow those who score between a 260 and 269 to also practice with some oversight. Those applicants will also need to practice for 2 years in either rural parts of the state or in a public law practice. With me to talk more about this is Stacey Leeds, the Willard H. Pedrick Dean at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. She says both she and her counterpart at the U of A Law School meet regularly with the Supreme Court and have had ongoing conversations about the bar exam and its cut score. So, Stacey, first off, what do you think about this plan from the court?
Well, we're very excited about it. I think it's a good compromise to some of the national dialogue around alternative pathways to licensure and bar exam scores. It's unlike what any other jurisdiction has done at this point. And, you know, I think it'll be a good thing for graduates, but also, you know, employers in the rural sectors and in the public service arena throughout our state.
What is the difference between somebody who gets a 260 and a 270? Like, how does the scoring work? What is the difference between those two scores?
You know, the margins are razor thin, and the National Board of Bar Examiners determined that a threshold competency score is 260, and then it gave the states the ability to decide anywhere between 260 and 280. Where they were going to come down for their particular state. So Arizona has been at the high end of the national cut scores for quite some time. And all of the states around us, New Mexico, Utah, several other states throughout the country, in the last few years have consistently lowered their score toward that 260 threshold. So it'll be an interesting, you know, data set to look at a year or two out, how many extra attorneys stayed in Arizona because of this new program where they could have taken that same cut score and gone to one of these neighboring states and immediately began practicing law.
Are you seeing that happen a lot, that students or applicants take the bar exam, don't get the 270 that's required in Arizona, and just leave and go somewhere else with the score that they got?
I wouldn't say we see it a lot, but we see it significantly enough that we, you know, raise this issue. You know, we definitely had graduates who, you know, let's say scored a 265, and instead of waiting and taking the bar exam twice here in Arizona, they chose to go ahead and go to one of these other states and immediately begin their career. So there certainly is the case that, as to some lawyers, Arizona was losing talent to go to one of these other states. So the numbers might not be substantial, but it was significant enough to address.
I'm curious about sort of the optics of this in terms of, you know, maybe somebody who needs a lawyer going to somebody who didn't quite get the 270. Maybe they got a 265 or a 268 or a 262. Is there a challenge in maybe explaining that to potential clients that, look, I get it. I, you know, this is what my score was. I'm still a very competent lawyer.
Well, I think when you look at other jurisdictions that either do not require the bar exam at all, like Wisconsin, or the jurisdictions that have a slightly lower cut score, they haven't seen substantial numbers of extra complaints against lawyers for not being able to practice, you know, law with the same capacity. So at least in the data sets, it hasn't led to, you know, greater incompetency in the legal profession. So, you know, that's some of the critique nationally about the bar exam. Are these numbers arbitrary, or are they numbers that, you know, provide a different barrier of protection for the consumers? You know, a 1 or 2 point difference in a bar exam score probably is irrecognizable in terms of what that person can do in practice.
In announcing this program, the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court pointed out that Arizona ranks 49th in the country in the number of lawyers per capita. What are the implications of that? Like, what does that mean for Arizonans who need legal representation?
Well, it means that we are squarely in an access to justice crisis, right? People can't always access the attorneys that they need, but it goes deeper than that. When you look at, even in Maricopa County and the more populous areas of the state, when you look at the job advertisements, you'll often see vacancies for attorneys for months and months. So there's jobs that are not filled right now, because there's not a steady enough pipeline of new attorneys, you know, coming for those jobs. So this will help those government service positions, but it also will target opportunities in the rural areas of the state. And, you know, everyone has recognized that this is a problem. This concept of legal deserts, where in some smaller counties, you might have just a handful of attorneys, including the judges, that are, you know, pursuing their career there. And it just creates a number of, you know, gaps in the justice system and delays in terms of getting relief. So for that rural component, as well as the government service component, I think that it will be a great start in trying to address those problems. Now, you likely know that Arizona was a leader in this concept of licensed paraprofessionals, people who are not attorneys, but they have some legal education that will equip them to take on certain kinds of cases, you know, in the system. And so it's the same rationale as that paraprofessionals program. Several years ago, when the Supreme Court began that program, it was for these same issues. There were all of these unmet needs.
What kind of dent do you think that this program might be able to put into that problem of clearly not having enough attorneys? Like, is this the answer? Is this one of the answers, do you think?
I think it's one of several solutions, but I think it's a very promising one. You know, in the first few years, it might be just a handful of new attorneys who enter into this, maybe something like 25 or 30. Right. But if you take that 25 or 30 and then you magnify that over several years, it really starts to make a difference. So it's not the solution, but it's a certainly good step toward that solution.
What else do you think the state can and should be doing here?
You know, there's another piece of it than the obvious piece that it would impact the two public law schools that we have here in Arizona. We have a vibrant economy in Arizona where people are looking to come to the state. Programs like this that would apply to graduates of any law school might tip the scale where some students who are graduating from law schools elsewhere around the country might consider coming here and working, you know, in Arizona as well. And so, you know, to that extent, it could help the state be a net importer of talent. And I think that everyone would agree that that's a good idea.
All right. That is Stacey Leeds, the Willard H. Pedrick Dean at the ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Stacey, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Okay, now let's all take a moment and listen to this sound. That is the sound of Carrie Ballou's Tibetan singing bowls, and they're part of what you'll hear if you attend one of her sound baths at her Scottsdale studio. Sound baths are something of a buzzword right now, with more people taking the plunge past yoga and into the sonic world of sound baths. And for Ballou, it was life-changing. She spent most of her career working in corporate America before turning her life upside down and training in this ancient practice. I visited her at her studio recently to learn more about it and hear her story.
For years, I was in all different types of corporate environments, from accounting to marketing and advertising. Eventually made my way into the construction industry, which was a really, really stressful time. And over those years of corporate work, corporate environments, I had really gotten to a point where I had so much anxiety, depression, trouble sleeping, just a massive amount of unhappiness. So this was something that was introduced to me, sound healing, because I desperately needed something to make a change.
What was that like, that moment in your life? Like, you're suffering from a lot of mental health issues. What made you turn to sound healing? I mean, that seems like an out of left field kind of solution. Had you tried everything else?
I was definitely into my yoga practice, but I had never embraced meditation, and I don't think a lot of people do. I think it has to come to you. I was in Los Angeles for the weekend, and I was just getting some downtime by the ocean, and a childhood friend of mine, had relocated out there, and she'd been healing herself from a lot of emotional turmoil, and she asked me if I'd ever had a sound bath before. And I said, no, but whatever that is, I need it. I'll try it. So I got back to town. I live in Scottsdale, and I was, you know, I kind of looked around, and then I kind of lost track of it, and life got busy again. And then on the yoga schedule, I saw gong meditation show up on a Sunday at 2:00, and I'm like, that's got to be what it is. I'm going to go try that out. And I went, and I laid down, and I just said, all right, whatever this is going to be, this is going to be. I'm interested. And basically 1 hour later, I was sitting there on the floor just saying, what just happened? Because I felt the most calm and the most peaceful and the most disconnected from all of the noise and the stress and the distraction that had become my normal for so long that it was just unbelievable to me how different I felt after that 1 hour.
So tell me about the other people in your life and their reaction to this, because it sounds like that was quite a life change. I mean, it sounds like it happened over a couple of years, and then you eventually did leave corporate America, and now you're running your own studio. You've really dedicated your life to this. But what did people in your life say when you were like, I'm going to become someone who runs sound healing sessions?
Well, you know, it was definitely different. Now, this wasn't a change of religion or religious practice. This was just opening my mind to a different way of seeing life entirely. And what I learned as I went through my training is that sound healing is the most ancient form of medicine. Yeah, I mean, I had some family members that were like, this is kind of loco, this is kind of out there. But it didn't bother me because I was getting better.
Okay, so like we said, we're in your own studio now. You run a studio now doing this. You spread the gospel of this, it sounds like, and have people in here for classes. It looks sort of like a yoga studio, except in the front, you have quite a setup here of instruments. It looks like bowls of different shapes, and you've got some candles. You've got things made of different materials. Of course, the gongs. Is that a bell? So describe for us just like the setup, the array, first of all.
I have an array of Tibetan singing bowls. As you see, they're made out of a multi-metal alloy. Those are going to have more of a tone of a range of different frequencies when I'm striking them and playing them. The crystal ones that you see, these are made of quartz, are more like a straight-up laser beam. They're going to have more of a very uniform tone as it absorbs into the body. Each of them are also tuned to the different chakras in the body, the seven energy centers that we have that go from the crown at the top of the head to the root chakra at the base of the spinal cord. And just like the octave scale, which goes from the note of C all the way to the note of B, that is the same lineup as the root to the crown chakra.
Let's hear it. Can you play it for us?
The root chakra bowl. This is called the solar plexus bowl, the E. The seventh one is the crown chakra, represented by the note of B.
That's really beautiful. So there's a bell back there and the gongs, of course. What do you use these for, and what do you use the different instruments for as you're, you know, sort of immersing people in a sound bath?
I usually will start with some combination of the bowls. They have a more harmonizing effect on the body because the goal is to drop the brainwave state out of that beta brainwave state, which is the active thinking, doing, can't turn my brain off, achieving, what have I got to do next brainwave state. That's when we're on the go and we're getting our day done. The meditative state is right between sleeping and waking. It's called alpha theta or theta brainwave state. So the number one goal that I have when I'm relaxing people into their sound bath experience is to change that brainwave state and to facilitate that relaxation. The gongs have a tendency to start to release the stagnant emotional energy that's caught up in the body. And I've had a lot of people have quite a bit of emotional release during a sound bath and even afterwards. That's a really good thing because I know that what happened in that 1 hour was very effective.
Can we hear them? I wonder, so as you do this, I'm sure you get a lot of people like you who come for the first time who have never experienced this before and maybe are a little skeptical. Do you ever get folks who are just like, what is going on here? And just think this is crazy?
I do. I think there's a lot more curiosity now. Naturally, just like a few years ago when you didn't see any men in yoga classes, that's changed a lot. But in here, you're going to see a lot less men showing up than women. Sometimes it's the husbands that come along and they're like, okay, what is this? So those are actually the people that I get the most gratifying feedback from.
So why? I mean, like, did afterward you have people telling you or crying or, you know, really seem affected?
Yes. I have heard everything. Now, not everything, because I've got a long way to go and a lot more years to do this and a lot more people to meet along the way. some people have visual experiences. When you're deep into the subconscious, into the meditative state, I saw a lot of colors flashing. Other people have told me that they had a spouse or somebody really close to them pass on, and they felt like that person was right there. You know, a lot of times people tell me, just from an emotional standpoint, I feel 1,000 pounds lighter.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you are so welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
That was my conversation with Carrie Ballou at Shanti Sound in Scottsdale. To see photos and some videos of her sound baths, head to our website. That's theshow.kjzz.org.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.